3 minutes 18 maart 2020, dit is het bulletin van woensdag. Minus 18 maart 2020, dit is het bulletin van woensdag, zonder fouten de datum uitgesproken. Nou, het is een unicum dit jaar. Wat gaan we doen vandaag? Ik ga de serie over propagatie ga ik mee verder. Ik heb daar eens wat dingen over te vertellen. Om te beginnen over dit soort series en met name de serie over propagatie. Daar is op PI2NOS toen die eerste serie werd uitgezonden wel eens wat over te doen geweest. Ik heb die eerste serie heel bewust geschreven om hem een keer te kunnen herhalen. Omdat ik vind dat het een belangrijk onderwerp is en dat blijft dan bij de mensen hangen. En herhaling is gewoon heel goed daarvoor. Omdat nog een keer je gedachten bij langs te laten gaan. Misschien een tweede herhaling. Maar in ieder geval, dat is vanaf het begin het doel geweest. Maar goed, heel veel mensen die wilden eigenlijk, die hadden zo'n mening van ja, als die elke dag wil uitzenden, dan moet hij ook elke dag een nieuwe uitzending maken. En dan moet ik alleen maar nieuwe onderwerpen inzitten. Ja, dat is niet helemaal haalbaar. En bovendien, in die serie zit ongelooflijk veel werk. En de serie nu schrijven kost zeker twee, drie keer zo lang als alle werk voor de rest van de uitzending. Je wil die moeite ook niet voor niks doen. Ik maak ook wel uitzendingen die veel minder werk kosten. Maar hier gaat gewoon veel tijd in zitten. Ook deze serie die schrijf ik dus om te herhalen. Dat is een doelbewuste keuze. Op NOS waren er nog wel één of twee mensen die zeiden van nou, je doet dat gewoon op de klieren. Maar dat is hier helemaal niet aan de orde. En die kan hier ook gewoon andere dingen vertellen. En die zal ik misschien, ik zal het misschien ook wel combineren met andere zaken. Er is in ieder geval hier meer tijd dan dat er op die repeater destijds was. Ik wil het ook niet te veel over PI2NOS hebben. Straks ga ik nog gefrustreerd klinken. En het was gewoon een leuke tijd om op terug te kijken. Dus ik heb daar ook niet naar herinneringen aan of zo. Maar er was wel eens wat kritiek en dat kwam ook wel eens, had ook wel eens tot gevolg dat er bepaalde dingen in de uitzending niet meer konden. En dat vond ik vervelend, want er kon sowieso een aantal dingen niet, omdat het op een amateurband was. Goed, maar deze serie ga ik dus om te beginnen in elk geval één keer herhalen en misschien twee keer. Dan is hij in totaal drie keer uitgezonden. En wat ik nu zal doen, omdat het vrij lang geleden is dat ik de eerste twee delen gedaan heb, zal ik die eerste twee delen achter deel 3 aanzetten, die ik nu hoop te brengen. De vorige keer hadden we het dus over de verschillende lagen in de ionosfeer. De ionosfeer die loopt van 50 tot 500 kilometer. Even recapituleren. De D-laag die bevindt zich tussen 50 en 90 kilometer hoogte. De E-laag hoger tussen de 90 en 140 kilometer. De F1-laag tussen 140 en 210 kilometer. En de F2-laag die is hoger dan 210 tot ongeveer 500 kilometer. En het ISS die vliegt dus, nou vliegt, maar die komt dus. Die bevindt zich gewoon in een hoger deel van die ionosfeer, van die F-laag, F2-laag bedoel ik. Dus zo hoog strekt die laag zich daaruit. Die verschillende lagen die werken ook verschillend. Door de verschillen in hoogte tussen E en F-lagen is de skipafstand die je met de E-laag kunt overbruggen beduidend kleiner dan die met de F-laag. Je kunt die lagen een beetje als een repeater zien. Een repeater in de F-laag die bevindt zich gewoon hoger dan in de E-laag. En de afstand is dan groter. Verder is er een heel groot verschil tussen de werking van de D-laag en de E- en de F-lagen. Die D-laag die buigt de signalen niet af, maar die verzwakt ze alleen maar. Die absorbeert ze in feite. Van alle lagen is de F2-laag eigenlijk de meest belangrijke voor propagatie op de korte golf. De redenen hiervan zijn als volgt. Ten eerste, de F-laag is 24 uur per dag aanwezig. Ten tweede, bij de propagatie over lange afstanden is de skipafstand, ik zei het al, het grootst. En daardoor heb je het minimale aantal hops nodig, het minimale aantal keren dat de golf tussen aarde en ionosfeer heen en weer kaatst. En iedere keer dat het signaal een keer tussen die beide lagen, tussen de aarde en die lagen heen en weer kaatst, dat zorgt weer voor extra verlies in signaalsterkte. Het derde argument is dat de F-laag gewoonlijk binnen het HF-bereik het hoogst in frequentie gaat. Ja, hoe worden die lagen nu gevormd? De vrije elektronen in de ionosfeer die zijn een raar fenomeen. Hoe hoger je komt, des te meer verschilt de situatie radicaal van de situatie hier op de grond. De vrije elektronen die worden gemaakt onder invloed van extreme ultravioletstraling en die van de röntgenstraling van de zon. Dat zijn de belangrijkste motoren achter de ionisatie. De vorming van de vrije elektronen dus in de ionosfeer. Elektronen kunnen worden geproduceerd wanneer deze straling botst met neutrale en geladen atomen en moleculen. Aangezien dit proces zonnestraling vereist, vindt de aanmaak van vrije elektronen uitsluitend plaats op het gedeelte van de aardbol waar de zon op de ionosfeer schijnt. Vrije elektronen gaan overigens ook weer verloren uit de ionosfeer wanneer ze combineren met geladen en neutrale atomen en moleculen. Dit verlies van elektronen vindt dag in dag uit ononderbroken plaats. De levensduur van die vrije elektronen neemt toe met de hoogte en ze leven dus het langst in het gebied van de F2-laag, wat ook de reden is waarom deze laag de hele nacht kan worden gebruikt en blijft bestaan. De typische levensduur van de vrije elektronen in de E-laag, dat is 20 seconden. In de F1-laag is het 1 minuut en in de F2-laag leven ze slechts 20 minuten. De reden waarom die vrije elektronen in de F2-laag toch tijdens de nachtelijke uren blijven werken en blijven bestaan is de grote turbulentie op dat soort hoogte. Binnen 20 minuten van hun korte bestaan kunnen die vrije elektronen op die hoogte zich van het lichte naar het donkere deel van de aarde bewegen. Het belangrijkste kenmerk van de ionosfeer voor HF-communicatie is het vermogen ervan radiogolven af te buigen dus. Er wordt echter slechts een bepaald frequentiebereik afgebogen. Ja, nu dacht ik al dat ik me niet versproken had, maar bij de laatste alinea ontspoorde ik nog. Op een bepaalde locatie, op een bepaald moment, zullen sommige van de hogere HF-frequenties de ionosfeer binnendringen, terwijl andere van de lagere HF-frequenties gedurende de hele dag worden geabsorbeerd en daarbij zeer veel worden verzwakt vanwege de invloed van de D-laag. Nou, volgende keer verder. Ah ja, een klein bedrijfsongevalletje. Namelijk, die oude afleveringen die heb ik niet de datum van genoteerd. Dus ik weet niet in welke podcast dat ze staan. Ik moet daar naar zoeken en daar is geen tijd meer voor. Ik improviseer nogal wat. Ik hoop dat het niet een uitzending is die maar een paar minuten lang is. Want het zou toch mooi zijn als er nog een paar minuten aan vastgeplakt worden. Al weet ik even niet wat te improviseren. Ja, ik heb al wat geïmproviseerd. een interview met David Fries. Whiskey One Hotel Kilo Juliet. David Fries is de maker van FL Digi. Dat is zeker interessant. Ik heb het interview meerdere keren gehoord. Van QSO Today is het. Het is echt de moeite waard. Het is wel in het Engels, maar het is echt de moeite waard. Hij vertelt over het feit dat hij op een gegeven moment enthousiast was voor, ik dacht voor morsetelegrafie en SSB. Maar in ieder geval, hij werd doof toen hij gepensioneerd werd, langzaamaan. En kon daar dus niet meer goed mee werken. En vervolgens is hij door toevalligheid met digitale communicatie in aanraking gekomen. En heeft van daaruit dat FL Digi steeds verder uitgebreid. Een monumentaal computerprogramma en een erg leuk interview. Dus dat komt nu.
QSO Today, episode 44. David Fries, W1HKJ. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, your host. My QSO today is with David Fries, W1HKJ, author of the FL series of software products, including FL Digi, winner of the 2014 ARRL Technical Excellence Award, longtime ham radio operator in Elmer. David's operating position has a number of computers in addition to radios. I'm quoting him from the Mac Ham Radio blog. Running all these computers is like an 8-manual organ. 90% of the time is spent on software development, 10% on operating. We will deep dive with David into FL Digi and other software later in this podcast. W1HKJ, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, David?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning, David. First, thanks for joining me on QSO today. Can we start at the very beginning of your ham radio story?
Sure can.
When and how did it begin? How did you become interested in amateur radio?
My high school years were spent in New York City, and I had a friend whose dad was a ham radio operator. And I guess I was maybe 14 or 15 at the time. Mm-hmm. I visited his home, and his dad was in the basement surrounded by racks of World War II vintage radio equipment. And he was operating CW at the time and carrying on a conversation with me and the CW conversation with the person on the other end of that QSO. And I just was flabbergasted to see someone able to do that. And it stuck in my mind for years. I didn't become a radio operator right away, but it was an experience that kind of piqued my interest in ham radio.
So you're an early vision of multitasking.
That's correct, yes.
Do you remember what year that was?
That was
about what time?
Yes, that was probably 1953, 1954.
Uh-huh. And when did you get your first license?
I went to the Coast Guard Academy, which is in New London, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And I was there from 56 to 60 as a cadet. And in 1957, I received my first call sign. And that was, let's see, I was 18 at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was a few years after that experience with my friend's dad. Mm-hmm. I actually learned CW first for flashing light. And I could send and receive flashing light CW at about 4 words per minute.
And was this how they would teach CW, was with a flashing light rather than a sound?
It was a requirement that you be able to send and receive CW with flashing light, because that was a mode of communications during radio silence.
Oh, from ship to ship?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, how about that? Well, that does make sense. That would be CW.
And at 4 words per minute doesn't sound very fast, but if you're operating a signal light, that's pretty fast.
And do you remember what your first call sign was?
Yes. Kilo 2 Lima Bravo Mike.
And that was a general class or?
No, that was actually KN2. I had a novice class first. And then I went to the general class later on. I've held several lights call signs along the way.
So you were a novice first?
Yes.
And you were in the Coast Guard Academy at the time that you got the novice.
That's correct.
Yeah. Did you have any Elmers or mentors at the Coast Guard who were hams?
Yeah, we had a group of people there who were all members of the Amateur Radio Club. And there were several. I can't pick out any one in particular. But there were a lot of people who were always willing to help you get your code practice up. They administered the tests at the time, because being in the military, the FCC allowed – what was now routine in terms of having an amateur radio operator administer a test. That was done for the military back in those days. So I only sat at an FCC exam when I went for my general class.
In New York at the FCC field office?
No, that was something. That was in actually Washington, D.C.
Ah. Uh-huh.
So I went to the
home of the FCC.
I went to the main office.
When you were in the military and you had this new novice license, was there a ham station there at
Yes, there was.
Coast Guard Academy?
Yes, we had an amateur radio station and an interesting antenna system. The radio station was on the fourth floor of a barracks area, and the barracks building was built as a large U-shaped building. Mm-hmm. And we were up actually in the attic area. And we had a long line, long wire antenna that was inside the attic area. And we used to tune it up by using fluorescent bulbs to make sure it was tuned properly.
I remember as a kid that we actually used to tune our transmitter into a incandescent light bulb.
Yes.
Just to make sure that we could tune it up before we put it into the antenna.
Oh, yes. I can recall doing that.
At this point, you didn't have a ham station of your own, or did you have a ham station at home?
No, I did not. No. My first at-home station was about 1967 or thereabouts. Up until that point, I'd always used the military ham stations, the club stations. My first actual station was a B&W 6100 with a Hammerlund receiver. The B&W 6100 was a single sideband phasing transceiver with more controls on the front panel than you would ever want to see.
And do you remember which Hammerlund receiver you had?
I can't recall. It's too far back.
Uh-huh. They were beautiful in those days.
Yes, they were. Yeah. Yeah. Big. Very big.
They were. Yeah, of course. How did ham radio play a part in the choices that you made for your education career after the military?
Well, actually, I have 24 years active duty. I retired active, wow, as an active duty member from the Coast Guard, uh-huh, plus an additional 13 years as a civil service member in the Coast Guard. So I've got about 37 years with the Coast Guard, and it's all been primarily in the realm of electronics and software development.
Uh-huh.
I was very instrumental in a lot of the hardware development for the Loran C system. It's no longer an active navigation system, but it was at one time. And just before I retired in 2000, I was the lead for all of the Coast Guard software development.
I would imagine that during your tenure at the Coast Guard, that the duties of the Coast Guard expanded as a result of the war on drugs.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, uh-huh, for interdiction of drugs that are trying to be smuggled into the country by sea.
Uh-huh.
And so, and there's quite a bit of that, a lot in the Caribbean and even on the West Coast. Drug people bringing up drugs, even, believe it or not, in homemade submarines.
So tell me, as a career military man in the Coast Guard, did you always live in military housing, and therefore were you able to operate?
No. The Coast Guard doesn't maintain a whole lot of military housing, so you're, mm-hmm, usually on your own. But I went to the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And, of course, I lived in Navy housing at that time. I did have both an amateur radio operating station at home, and I also used the one at the school. I was stationed in Alaska at a remote isolated duty station during the 1964-65, mm-hmm, and that was the time when we had the very big earthquake in Alaska. And I did have an amateur radio station with me at the time there. An interesting antenna. It was the only time I was able to build a rhombic, and that was a very large rhombic, 600 foot on each leg, and it was a terminated rhombic aimed to the east coast of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And where were you in Alaska?
Stationed in a place called Yakutat, and that's in the Tongass National Forest, about halfway between Anchorage and Juneau. It's a community of about 500 Tlingit Indians.
So there was plenty of real estate for a rhombic antenna.
Oh, more than enough. Uh-huh. And lots of
and
trees to hang it from.
Perform?
I'm sorry?
And how did that antenna perform to the East Coast?
I was going to tell you how well it performed. At the time of the earthquake, Yakutat was declared to have been obliterated from the earth. At least that's what many of the broadcast stations had announced. And, of course, my wife was not with me. She was back in the New York area with our two children at the time. And she was wondering what would happen to me up there. And I was able to get on the radio, on ham radio, and make one call for a contact to the East Coast. And I called for the New York City area. And within that one call, I had about a dozen stations willing to help me. And so I had a nice phone patch. Mm-hmm. Which allowed me to ensure her that I was still alive and she was not ready to cash in the insurance money.
So obviously it sounds to me like perhaps your military career actually had more of an impact on your family life than amateur radio did. But what kind of impact did amateur radio have on your family life?
Well, that was a positive impact, certainly, because my wife was able to be reassured that I was still around. Mm-hmm. But it's had a negative impact in a lot of ways, mostly because I'm so intense about what I do. And my wife likes to say that she's a ham radio widow. And so I have to be careful I don't allow my interests in ham radio to overwhelm my domestic duties.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's probably true of a lot of amateur radio operators.
Yeah, my wife decided she wanted to pursue a PhD about 4 years ago, and I said, oh, what a great idea, because if she's pursuing her PhD, I'm doing amateur radio.
Yeah.
It's about to end. I have to find her some other avocation.
Okay.
You have two children.
I have three boys, three sons, okay. And they're all age 50 and over at this point.
And any of them ham radio operators?
None, but they're all in the electronics industry.
So what kind of rig do you operate now?
I have a Yaesu FT950 that I use most of the time. I also have a Tentec Pegasus and a Kachina 505 DSP. The Kachinas were actually very, very nice transceivers, but probably overpriced for and weren't very successful at the during the period of time that they sold them.
Okay, and it's my understanding, because you make a note someplace, that you run a 2-meter copper magnetic loop antenna on 40, 30, and 20.
I have a 2-meter copper loop antenna that I built. I use it mostly on 30, primarily because I failed to complete my control unit for the variable vacuum variable. And so I leave it set on 30 meters. It works great.
Uh-huh. And what is it exactly? When you say 2 meters in diameter, that's a pretty large loop antenna.
Yes.
What's the diameter of the tube that you're using?
Oh, I'm using 3/4-inch copper tubing. And I'm sitting right here looking at it out my window. It's only about 5 meters away from me. Mm-hmm. And it's all kind of brazed construction.
And it wow.
With a very small copper ground wire. Piece of copper ground wire used for the driving element.
Amazing. And how does that antenna perform compared to your wire antennas? Because I understand you've got, you also have some fan dipoles.
Fan dipoles. Well. And I also have a vertical that can tune to 30. It performs equally well. I've used it in comparison by looking at some of the reports from some of the robot receiving stations, mm-hmm. and it's about equal.
And it's a quiet antenna compared to, say, the vertical?
Yes. Oh, very, very quiet. Yes. What's interesting is I have the antenna so that the null of the antenna is aimed at my ham shack.
Uh-huh.
And I can go in the air with 100 watts and never get any RFI in the shack. And the antenna is just almost within arm's reach.
Of your ham shack?
Yes. Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's.
Well, that's one of my projects this summer is to build a 20-meter receiving loop. Because of the electronic noise we have here.
Yes. Well, it'll reduce it quite a bit.
So what's your favorite operating mode?
Well, for years it was CW. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even find a microphone unless I was absolutely forced to do so. But I lost my hearing about the time I retired in 2000. And so CW became more and more difficult. And a friend of mine suggested that I should think about digital modes. And he suggested I look at a program called GMFSK. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not, but GMFSK was written by a fellow named Tomi Manninen, OH2BNS. And I think Tony was going to school and it was becoming too difficult for him to maintain it. So by de facto, I became the maintainer of the program, made some changes. I didn't intend to publish it, but somehow it leaked out that I had made changes to GMFSK. And so for about 3 years, I was the maintainer for that program. At that point, I decided I might want to try to do this on my own. Tomi's code was excellent. I could take most of it. And using it as a basis, I could write a C++ application, which turned out eventually to be FL Digi. But since that time, I operate almost entirely digital mode. My favorite two modes are PSK31 and MFSK16. But I think that's simply because they're the easiest ones to make a QSO with.
Uh-huh.
There's so many people out there using them. There are better modes than either one of the two.
Mm-hmm. But they seem to be the most popular.
Yes, they are the most popular.
Well, you're best known for FL Digi. And you now have a very respectable list of free software products with the FL designation in front. Can you talk a little bit about FL Digi and what it is and why someone would use FL Digi if they're pursuing the digital modes?
Well, the first thing is it's public domain software. Because it was based in part on some of the work that Tomi did, it continued to be a general public license software, which means that all of the code is available to you. So if you have any skills at all, in the C++ language, or if you'd like to become skilled in it, the code itself is like a textbook on how to design digital signal processing elements for both encoding and decoding digital transmissions. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of comments in there which allows you to really understand what's happening internally. FLDigi is a general purpose digital signal processing modem program that allows you to send and receive on about, I think the current count is around 40 different digital modes if you include all of the submodes. It includes the ability to send images using MFSK in a picture mode. The digital modes are a fantastic way to communicate because you can have nearly 100% QSO, a signal-to-noise ratio that is much below what you could ever expect to even do with CW.
Plus, you have all of the ASCII characters.
Yes. Actually, FLDigi uses a UTF-8 character set. Mm-hmm. So it's beyond the ASCII character set. You can send and receive in Cyrillic, which would include Greek, Russian, Ukrainian, probably Czechoslovakian as an example. You could send and receive using the Hebrew character set if it's available in the UTF-8 format. Mm-hmm. Voice of America uses FLDigi for all of its digital broadcast over its AM broadcast radios, and they routinely send out broadcasts in Chinese or other Asian languages that use the UTF-8 character set. So it's pretty widely used by a number of different places outside of amateur radio even.
Well, that's amazing. So Voice of America has identified a user base of listeners that actually could use FLDigi or, you know, to actually receive or something like that?
Yes, that's true.
Wow.
And FLDigi was originally my own creation, but over the years it's grown much beyond what I can do. I have a team of about 20 different developers who are at various times are either active or idle, but they're all there. It's a worldwide consortium, including mm-hmm. people in Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Israel. There's a gentleman in Australia who has taken all of the FLDigi code and ported it over to an Android application. He calls it AND FL Message. It's a combination of FLDigi and the FL Message generator that I wrote. And it can be used to receive any of the digital broadcasts, including the ones made by VOA. The Voice of America, after they've made their publish, the fellow named Kim Elliott usually sends me some feedback as to various reception reports. And mm-hmm. some of those were by people receiving the FLDigi digital broadcast using a tablet, an Android tablet, or even an Android phone.
So they're actually receiving an off-the-air signal, or the Voice of America is kind of pumping FLDigi into the internet somehow? I mean,
no, it's off the air, on the air. Uh-huh. And in fact, if you visit VOA online site, you can probably look up what their schedule is for the broadcast. It's every Saturday and Sunday, uh-huh. and there's several broadcasts on different frequencies from different transmitting stations around the world. Some in the U.S., some in Asia, and some in Europe. You probably get the one from Germany very well.
Oh, so I understand what's going on. So they've got the speaker turned up on the radio, and they're using the microphone on the Android device.
That's correct.
Device.
That's how they're doing it.
Okay.
And the broadcast from VOA is on AM radio. And so you can either listen to it, you know, the AM broadcast, or you could look at upper or lower sideband to look at one of the two. But it's really quite effective. He's tried testing it with the FLDigi broadcast in the background with music still continuing in the foreground. And that works, but it, the music sometimes provides the equivalent of noise background. So most of the time, his broadcasts are only in the FL-Digi digital mode, and it's just applied to the AM signal.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool. And
yeah, it's very cool.
He always sends MFSK as well as other modes. The primary mode he uses is MFSK. And so he'll always send a sequence of digital photos, images, along with various elements of the broadcast.
Well, now you've piqued my interest in just to see what the Voice of America is doing.
Yeah, you'll have to download FL-Digi so you can receive it.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? When I was looking at the FL-Digi site, it appeared to me that there's a lot of other features in FL-Digi that have been added. Well, can you explain, you know, what other things that FL-Digi does besides encoding and decoding the various digital modes?
Sure. If you look at my website, you'll see that there's a number of the FL applications. By the way, FL stands for fast light, because all of the user interface GUI code that I use to support the programs is the fast light toolkit, FLTK. So I just kept the FL. It just everyone wants to know what FL means.
Well, it actually was one of my questions here on my list.
Yeah, it's borrowed from FLTK, which is the toolkit used for the user interface.
Okay.
But one of my interests, and I guess generated by my experience in Alaska so many years ago, 50 almost now at this point, is in emergency communications. And so much of what FL-Digi has been designed to do over the last several years is to be a platform for the base platform for emergency communications. And in fact, if you look on there, you'll see something called my brain is getting cramped. Well, anyway, okay. There's a sequence of programs in there that are all designed specifically for the EMCOM usage.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes FLARQ, which is an amateur radio receive request type of thing. So it's, think of the old days, we used to do packet and
digipeding.
Yeah, digipeding. FLARQ provides that kind of facility. It means that you can pass data back and forth in a way that you have a checksum associated with all of data. And so you know for sure whether or not it's been received correctly or not. If not, you do a repeat request. There's something called FLAMP, which is amateur multicast protocol, and that's a way of doing broadcasts over a repeated broadcast so that the receiver can receive the same broadcast multiple times. And when the broadcast has been received in its entirety and checksummed, so it's not that the reception has been 100%, then that individual will know that it's received that. So that's being used in multiple ways in the emergency communications arena. There's something called FL Message, which is a forms manager with many, many different forms that are canned and ready to go, or any kind of an HTML form can be used as the basis for form within that program. But all of these things that I just mentioned so far are specifically designed to be used by the emergency communications people, RACIs, ARIES, and those type of people. And they're all interfaced directly or indirectly to FL-Digi. So, for example, FL-AMP communicates via a socket interface with FL-Digi, so it can control whether FL-Digi is transmitting or receiving, etc. The same thing with FL-Message. If you were on an emergency communications frequency and FL-Digi decoded an FL-Message formatted transmission, it would automatically open up FL-Message and display the message that came in. So there's a lot of ancillary things going on that a lot of people don't use, but it was there because of my interest in the emergency communications field. And I'm not a RACES member. I'm not an ARIES member. So I create these things for other people to use.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got my brain is sitting here, spinning at 100 miles an hour in terms of what you could do with this. So this means if I wanted to set up, with my friends here, an emergency message network.
Yes.
That works the whole country. Now, our country is the size of New Jersey, but it's not like the United States. But you could use like 40 meters, for example, as a message handling network.
Yes.
You could actually, spit the message into the system and it could find its way from one end to the other, even if it has to be repeated some intermediate points along the way.
That's correct. FLAMP, for example, has the ability to operate in a repeat mode. So that station A can initiate the initial broadcast, and station B or C down the line could rebroadcast it, and the final recipient could be receiving the information from A, B, and C, and reassembling the entire message.
Do you know if there's any message networks in place across the world that are already doing this?
Yes, there are. Most of them are in the U.S. Uh-huh. And there's probably 20 or so different EMCOM groups that are using all of this software during real emergencies, and also during much of their drills.
Mm-hmm.
The northeast part of our country, particularly Massachusetts, got hit very hard this last winter season by very heavy snowfalls.
Mm-hmm,
and other storms. And the Cape Cod ARIES group used FLDigi and all of the other programs specifically for all of its emergency communications. And they were doing it on UHF, VHF, and it works equally well there, either on sideband or FM. They were using FM on VHF. And there are some modes available for the UHF VHF operator that are extremely high speed, up to about 6,000 words per minute. And so it's almost like instant message servicing, but over amateur radio. And so they were using the FL message with FLDigi and some of its very high speed PSK modes.
Yeah, this comes up frequently in QSO Today conversations, and that is that the internet infrastructure that we rely on so heavily is actually quite fragile. And I can think of a time just a few years ago when a ship threw its anchor in the water outside of Alexandria, Egypt, and snagged a submarine cable and took out most of the Middle East from the internet. As a result of that. Yeah, my mind is spinning here in terms of ways that it would be possible to, continue sending messages, even through across gateways from as third-party traffic.
Yes.
From one end of the world to the other, just to let people know that things like, I would imagine, for example, something like this in Nepal right now would be quite handy and useful.
Yes, indeed. I think so. All of the messages that are handled by all of this software are mm-hmm. are pure text messages. There's no binary data involved in it. So the file associated with the data transfer could be picked up and transferred, if it's available, via an internet connection. But when that's not available, then also this data can be sent via amateur radio. Most of the times when the drills have been run with other emergency communications people that might be like EMTs or hospitals, they've really been surprised at how effective this communication mode of communication can be and how well it transfers the data. And there are some things that are very difficult to transfer if you are simply using voice radio. If you were trying to transfer a list of drugs, for example, if you needed to have emergency list of drugs to be sent to somebody, that'd be a very difficult list to transfer using voice. But absolutely 100% transferred without any errors using all of these digital modes.
Can you use FL Digi with any of the satellite modes? I mean, can you store up your messages for interception by a satellite that might pass overhead?
I don't know of anyone doing it right now, but there's no reason it couldn't be, because it's simply an audio signal, mm-hmm. and it's like passing any other audio signal. That's just another medium.
What's on the drawing board for FL software products? Do you have any ideas brewing right now in terms of what else you could do with it that you're not doing now?
Yes. yes, there is. So
can you share?
I'm always doing something. I don't know if you recognize these two gentlemen, but there's a fellow named Murray Greenman, ZL1BPU, and Khan Wasilev, ZL2AFP. They live in New Zealand, obviously. Mm-hmm. Murray is the inventor of several different digital modes, including MFSK and Domino EX. If you're not into digital modes, they may not be very familiar.
I've heard of these, actually.
Actually, he's the man that invented them. Mm-hmm. I invented one called Thor, which is very similar to Domino EX. But Murray has recently invented a mode called FSQ. And it stands for Fast Simple QSO. And it's a little bit different than most digital modes that people are used to, because it's, as opposed to character-based, it's line-based. You type in a line of text, hit the return, and that line of text goes out, and you wait in return for another line of text coming back. A little bit slower, perhaps, than some of our modes now, but the actual modem code is such that it can go to about minus 15 dB signal-to-noise ratio in terms of being able to be decoded successfully. So that's pretty far down the noise.
Right. So you're not even – with your ears, you're not even hearing.
Yeah, all you're hearing is noise. No, that's right. Yeah. You might be able – most digital modem programs use a waterfall to basically display a frequency display in time, mm-hmm. with the intensity of the signal being indicated by both color and color intensity. You might see some of those digital signals in there, but they would be mixed in among all the noise. But anyway, he has a program called FSQCALL, FSQ Call, which was written by Khan, but it's only available in Windows. And I hate to admit it, but I'm kind of a Linux geek. Uh-huh. I've done Unix all my life, only Windows under duress. And so I was asked if I would include FSQ as a modem under FL Digi, and I've been working on that, and it's about at the 95% point. And in fact, all of FL Digi is available in multiple operating systems. It's built on a Linux platform, but I write a cross compiler, so it's available under Windows. And it's also available on OS X. So it's available on all the major OS platforms. And so,
well, I wrote that you admitted that you actually own a Windows computer.
I have a Windows 8.1, a Windows XP, a Windows version 7. I need them because I have to test this stuff.
Uh-huh.
In fact,
so you don't job that off to someone else.
No, we're on an 8.1 right now, so I'm talking to you on Windows.
Uh-huh.
I'm rather OS gnostic. That doesn't make any difference what I use, but I prefer Linux. But at any rate, the objective was to be able to add this new modem type called FSQ to FL Digi, because it has a lot of potential in the EMCOM community. It really can provide them with some additional tools to use. So that's probably going to be out in either the next version or the one after that. It's getting pretty close to being released.
How long does it take for one of these new digital modes to propagate across the ham radio community before you've got someone to talk to?
Oh,
I mean, does it take long?
No, it doesn't. as soon as you're out there and somebody recognizes a mode they haven't seen before, they're on the internet looking to see what that was. And so, so it doesn't take very long. And the internet, you know, it's fragile, but it's super. I couldn't do any of this work if I didn't have the internet resources available to me. I have, you know, this group of 20 developers over the whole world, and we communicate almost all the time using the internet, and that's how we share our work.
Well, I wasn't complaining about in the internet. The internet makes it possible for me to sit here and talk to you the way I'm, you know, talking to you now, and to be able to put out the QSO Today podcast. I guess my only concern is that, you know, when there's a real natural disaster, you know, you can't rely on it. At least, you know, maybe not locally, if the local infrastructure is has been buried or washed away or blown away.
I live in Tornado Alley. In fact, the area I live in is just north of Huntsville, Alabama. And I've had tornadoes come within 2.5 miles of the house. And so I'm very aware of what natural disasters can do to the infrastructure.
This is why you have wire antennas instead of that 60-foot tower with the monster beam on the roof.
Actually, I would have the tower, but it, you know, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, and my wife would not think that a beautiful object.
It's funny how different we are.
I know.
I keep telling my wife I want to put a hex beam on the roof, and she said the neighbors will, you know, burn you at the stake. So,
well, they might do the same if you build your loop antenna.
You know, I can put the loop antenna out on the back, and people will think it's like a dream catcher or something like that.
That'll be good. You're aware of it. You know all about dream catchers.
Well, I don't, but I know what they kind of look like, and and I probably could sell that to most of the neighbors.
It's an American Indian thing, actually.
Yeah. So with FLDigi, then, if there's a new mode and you've got this new mode, you know, in the latest version of FLDigi, if I'm tuning around the band and I'm not, for example, I haven't tried FSQ call, will FLDigi automatically switch into that mode when it crosses the band and start decoding it and tell you what it is that you're looking at? Or do you actually have to manually go through and try each mode to see if you can decode what's there?
That's a very good question, Eric. There's a fellow named Patrick, who's the developer of another digital mode program, who created something called RSID, which is a Reed-Solomon identification sequence. And RSID is a special transmission that can precede any digital transmission. And when decoded, will automatically take your program and either tell you what the new mode is and or change to it automatically and start decoding it. FLDigi uses RSID identifiers for almost 100% of its digital modems. It doesn't do it for some, and some of them you really don't need it. You don't want it for CW, for example. And most people, if they've been around long enough, can tune to a radio teletype signal and recognize an RTTY signal just from the sound. But many of the more esoteric modes, you wouldn't know what it was you were listening to unless you had spent many, many hours listening to them. So the RSID is an identifier code that's sent. It's a separate type of a code from all the rest of them, and it allows your program to automatically identify the mode, change to it if you've configured it for that to do so. And so when I publish FSQ for FLDigi, it will have associated with it an identifier mode, an RSID code.
Is that a convention that you've created, or is there like some international agreement on what these RSID codes should be for each of these modes?
It's an agreement between those of us who are in the development community for digital modem programs. The fellow who invented the RSID code is Patrick, and he created multi-PSK, which is a program principally for Windows users. And he's rather possessive of the codes, but he gives out, he'll give out a block of codes to various developers, and he's done that for FLDigi. So for code sequence modem codes which are unique to FLDigi, I have a set of a block that I can draw upon for this RSID assignment.
But now, I got the impression from looking at your site with the FLDigi site that you also have some rig control.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, FLRig is a transceiver control program that has all of the back-end code in it for about 50 different transceivers, probably a vintage 1980 plus to current, supports many, many different transceiver manufacturers, and it's a common interface and a common user interface, so that for every transceiver, the interface that you see on the computer screen, it's identical. That means that, you know, some transceivers don't have every little bell and whistle that it's been keyed for, but for every requirement for the digital mode operation, those transceivers are supported. And so, for example, you can via FLDigi, communicating to FLRig, communicating to the transceiver, you can either query or control things like frequency, mode of operation at the transceiver, bandwidth at the transceiver, notch filtering at the transceiver, various other aspects of transceiver operation. So when I'm using FLDigi with my Yaesu FT950, I never touch the transceiver except to turn it on or off.
Oh, interesting. So if I wanted to operate Whisper, we had Carol Malazzo, KP4MD, on, who was doing some experiments with Whisper in VHF and UHF. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to use the Whisper mode when I'm working on some other transceiver, or I'm doing something else in my ham shack, and I wanted to kind of go through the different bands and beacon and receive, could you do that with FLDigi with an FLRig?
No. FLDigi does not support the Whisper mode.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. It's not within primarily because it doesn't fall into the EMCOM purview.
Okay. But you could conceivably do something similar in one of the other digital modes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Even program it for different times.
The way it's set up, there's a complete macro, what's called a macro language, that's available to an FLDigi user. And so he can set up for FLDigi to automatically change the transceiver at specific times, so that it could move to a different frequency or different mode, different band.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
David, go ahead.
That's why there's about 500,000 lines of code.
So it keeps you busy in your retirement.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
David, what is the biggest challenge to ham radio to you?
I think the integration of our HF and VHF communications with the internet services, so that we can have transparency, especially for the emergency communications people. That transparency isn't quite here yet. It takes a bit of handling on a part of individuals to get that message transport between the various media.
I see. So what you're talking about perhaps is that barrier where the licensed ham radio operator is actually the mediator between the third party traffic and the amateur radio service itself.
Right. You know, some of that, of course, is limited by regulations and laws within the various countries that we operate, either within or between. And so we have to be aware of those also. But I think we need to have a little bit more transparency between them, so that if I'm sending a message from point A to point B, it shouldn't make any difference, you know, what the mode of transmission is.
Unless that that transmission is an advertisement.
Well, then you'd have a problem because that would be prohibited yeah. under most laws.
Well, what advice would you give to a new or returning ham to amateur radio with all your years of experience?
Read the manual.
Well, you know better than that, David. We, as ham radio operators, we never read the manual.
I just bought a new automobile, and before I drove it, I read the manual. But I'm probably unique. No, most people just figure they can fly by the seat of the pants. I guess the best advice I can give people it would be, especially if they're into the digital modes, uh-huh. is to seek out help on the internet. And there are for FLDigi, for example, and for others, FLDigi has three different Yahoo groups with approximately 8,000 members between the three of them. Depending upon whether you're a Windows operator or a Linux operator or an OS X operator, or if you're interested primarily in emergency communications, you would probably move to one of those three different groups. I could let you have the names of them, but they're all acronyms. But you can look them up on
No, Yahoo. What I'll do is I'll look them all up and I'll put them in the show notes page.
That's good. But they're all Elmers on there. They're all willing to help you. And so uh-huh. there's all kinds of help available to a new, especially a novice operator within the digital modes.
This is a whole universe that I'm not familiar with. This is really cool. I'm grateful that you came on to QSO today, David. And from looking at FLDigi and hearing what you're saying, I guess I have to expand my list of to-dos this year, and that's to include starting to operate some of the digital modes just to see how they work out for me.
Oh, I think you'll love it. It's a lot of fun.
I want to thank you so much for joining me on QSO today. Again, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
73.
It's been my pleasure.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed my QSO Today with David W1HKJ. Be sure to check out the show notes page at www.qsotoday.com and put in W1HKJ in the search bar at the top of the page. I will post links to the references that David made in the podcast. If you have any questions for David, please be sure to put them in the comments section at the bottom of the W1HKJ show notes page. QSO Today is available in the iTunes Store and in the Stitcher podcast app for both iPhone and Android. There are links to these places on the QSO Today website. I'm always on the lookout for interesting guests for the podcast. Your suggestions are very important to finding QSO Today guests. Please send me your suggestions on the comments page at www.qsotoday.com at the website. Please take the time to join the QSO Today community. There are buttons on the website and on the show notes page for this. I promise not to spam you or share your email address with anyone. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73.
I'm Peter John in English Media. Title music is by Croatian artist Blasko and is published under Creative Commons. You can find this podcast on dmpodcast.net, DM is for Daily Minutes, and on several other platforms. De internetfaciliteiten en studio hardware voor Daily Minutes worden gesponsord door 70MHzShop.nl, 70MHzShop.nl.
Daily Minutes Podcast. Whoever hears this is crazy.
En microfoon naar de toer.